Through the book of Job, 17th lesson in our series, A Survey of the Old Testament. And as you can see at the top of your handout, I have titled or given the book a subtitle for tonight, A Righteous Man Suffers. And I think as you read through the whole book, you can kind of condense it down into this one summary statement. And that is, burdened by Satan's bitter testing, Job questions God's purposes for allowing him to suffer. And that is a question that a lot of us still face today. Why does God allow the righteous to suffer? And that hopefully will be something that we can address as we go on to this evening. The title of the book is Job, obviously. It's named after the main character of the book. And this name goes back to the Arabic root word that signifies one who turns back, one who repents. The root that forms Job's name is frequently followed in several contexts by one who turns back to God. His name was rendered to other forms in ancient Arabic and Akkadian, and if you look at the other languages that it was changed into, it occurs in several important texts, identifying a man with a similar name as being a very important prince in the area of Pela, Ayab, a prince of Pela, and Ayabum, a prince near Damascus around 1800 BC. So it's possible, if you believe this is referring to the man Job, who is discussed in the book of Job in our Bible, that there are other records outside of the Bible of who he was. So Job is not a Hebrew name. And that's interesting to realize because it shows up in the Hebrew Bible, even though Job was not a Jew. If Job was a Jew living in the time of the patriarchs, one would think that their names would have shown up in the text, but they don't. Also, you would think that if he had been living during the time when the law was given, there would have been an emphasis on the law and certain aspects of keeping the law. Job defends himself numerous times throughout the book, saying that he is a righteous man. And if he had received the law from God as a standard that he could have held up and said, I am righteous by this standard, then he surely would have done so. But you don't see that. And another reason why we can say that Job was not a Jew is that several of the interactions and the way that Job's three friends address him are better fitting for an Arabian culture than for the Hebrew culture. Who was the author of the book of Job? Well, some suggest Moses, or in favor of a later date, even Solomon. But as I just said, the book doesn't display the knowledge of God or divine law that would have been present if it had been written by a later author. Now, it's hard to quantify that, but the knowledge of God's law is relatively absent from the book of Job. There is a strong basis in the general moral statutes that all people, as a general rule, would hold up and say, this is a good thing, this is a bad thing. But the law of God, the Ten Commandments, is missing. The special qualities of the law of God, given to the children of Israel in particular, are missing. So, I can't prove this definitely, but I would almost tend to say that the author was the man himself, Job. As a very wealthy man, he could have possessed the required knowledge or had the money to pay for someone who had the appropriate knowledge to have the events recorded. He may have dictated them. And as you look at people who propose other authors apart from Job, one of the key objections that they raise is, how could Job have recorded the events of the prologue and then the conclusion if he was in the time itself? Didn't that require an extra bit of revelation? The events in the prologue are when we see Satan coming before God and talking to God in the throne room. And that's not something that we would normally get to see and definitely required revelation. But I think this could be answered in two ways. First, he probably would not have written until the story was over. If you're really sick, covered in boils, trying to make heads or tails of the whole situation, that's not when I would be most likely to sit down with my clay tablet and my chisel and start chiseling cuneiform into the text, trying to record what's happening. He probably waited until the story was over. And then second, since God was communicating with him already at the end of the book, I don't think it would be strange or unusual to suppose that God could not, would not have also revealed to him the reason for his suffering. And maybe he revealed it to Job, and then Job just put it at the beginning of the story because he knew the whole situation. The events of Job occurred a little bit before Abraham. So Job, if you add up the years of his life, I believe you can find 200 as a rough estimate, a lifespan that was already decreasing very rapidly from what it had been before the flood and before the Tower of Babel. How do you get 200 years? Well, if you look back through the book, you find out that at the end of the book, he was rewarded with 140 extra years of life. And if you look before his testing, you know that he had 10 children who were fully grown and living on their own. So if you assume that he was 20 years old when he started having his children, had one a year, that put him at 30. And by the time his youngest was fully grown, say 30 years old, that puts him at 60. And then 140 years added on top of that would be 200. So he's a relatively, he's getting up in age by the time the events began in the book of Job. Another reason we believe it happened a little bit before Abraham is that Job's wealth was measured primarily in animals instead of coinage or silver and gold money that could be used at a market in place of bartering with animals. Coinage is one of the ways that a civilization expresses cohesion, and societies that mark wealth with animals, like Abraham did for much of his life, gradually begin to dissipate even during Abraham's own life. So if you look at Genesis 23, 13 through 16, Abraham in his life is bartering for a plot of land, and he offers 300 shekels, which was current money with the merchants. So it was a coin. It was something that could be used to buy goods instead of giving an animal in exchange. But nevertheless, money does not really appear in the book of Job until the very end of the story, when all of his friends came back after he was healed and gave him a piece of money, just one piece, a piece of money and a golden earring. That's in Job 42, verse 11. The fact that they gave him one piece doesn't really lend a lot of support to having a very money or coinage-based society. As you read through the book of Job, who are the key people? Well, you start with God and Satan. These two characters, just like we learned in Esther, these two characters form the backdrop for the whole story, really. You could almost say that the whole story of the events of Job is God's proof to Satan that people don't only serve me because I'm good to them. They serve me because they love me. And as the book begins, God is talking to Satan and saying, "Have you seen my servant Job? There is none like him in all the world, a man who does not like evil and follows me." Satan is not convinced. And as he argues back with God, persuades God to allow him the permission to attack Satan, his body eventually, and his wealth. Job, then, the main character of the story, is the righteous man who receives Satan's hand of cursing as God's way of demonstrating Job's unwavering loyalty to him. The next three main characters, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, are Job's three friends that came to visit him in the midst of his distress. They were bound by the prevailing views of good and evil. That said, evil people received evil from God if they did evil things. Their counsel to Job, although well-intentioned, no doubt they wanted to help him in their heart, they missed the mark completely because they misunderstood God's character and his treatment of evil and the reason for suffering. The last character, however, Elihu the Buzite, is the only one who displayed a modicum of wisdom in his counsel to Job and his answers to the others. It's interesting as you read the story that you're not told when he arrived. The three friends came, and then he shows up at the end. And I mentioned it when I talked about those three friends, but they believed that man received evil from God when he did an evil thing. And that's something that you can very easily understand when you realize that they lived just after the flood, just after the Tower of Babel. That was probably what they really thought. It was probably very widespread. You realize people sin. They turned away from God before the flood, so God sent the flood, destroyed the earth. Only 8 people got on the ark and lived to come into the new world that was completely changed. And then after man sinned again, God confused the whole world by giving them all different languages, scattering them to the 4 corners of the world. So throughout the world, there must have been an opinion of God that if you do evil, or if you get evil, you get bad back in your life, then it's probably because you're sinning. When Job's friends came to him, it's almost as if they were expressing a bit of pre-karma in their thought. Now, karma is, I guess basically, if you were to summarize it, the law of sowing and reaping. And if Job, if you believe he lived around 2000 BC, the events, the teachings that eventually became karma, known as karma, in the organized religions of Brahmanism, Hinduism, then later Buddhism, must have already been in place because these religions came along not long after that. But Job's life and the story of Job clearly demonstrates that there is more to suffering than simple karma. A karma, the law of sowing and reaping is an oversimplification because karma does not take into account the fact that there is a monotheistic God who is the absolute standard for right and wrong. And Job's suffering was obviously not caused by his wrongdoing. We'll look at that more as we go through the book. The setting then for the events is in Palestine or Arabia. Now, it depends on who you look at. Some people will say that it was in Arabia and then that the events were recorded by Moses when he was down in Mount Sinai taking care of his father-in-law's sheep. But if you look at the documents that I quoted or cited earlier, the Berlin Exequatory texts and the other documents, then they place him up more towards Palestine in the area of Moab. So we really can't say dogmatically where it took place, but we know it was more of an Arabian culture in the Middle East. And what happened in the book? We won't spend a lot of time going over the summary tonight, but if at the beginning, you see God and Satan discussing Job's righteousness. And that's in the first 2 chapters. The upshot is God gives Job permission to go and take away, God gives Satan permission to go and take away Job's possessions as a test to find out if possessions and God's protection are what made him serve God. The remainder, or most of the remainder of the book, is composed of conversations that kind of go in a circle. The first round of speeches, Job, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, they come and his three friends are saying, you need to repent because you've sinned. Job says, I haven't sinned, I've been upright. And then the next cycle, they say basically the same thing. Job comes back, says similar. And then the third cycle as well. But at the end of the book, a new character comes in, Elihu, and he praises God's character and attributes Job with guilt for questioning God's fairness, accusing God of being unfair in his treatment of him, even though he knew that he had not been evil. And at the conclusion of the book, the last conversation, really, is God speaking to Job and his friends from out of a whirlwind. And in these chapters, we discover that God's matchless power is displayed in creation. We also discover that God is powerful and man is absolutely frail. And then Job gets the proper response and covers his mouth because he is unable to respond to God in his holiness. He responds in humility by not answering back. And at the end of the book, God restores Job to his previous wealth and actually far beyond it. The last several verses of chapter 42 teach us several things. Number one, God in no way sanctioned Job's friends' false idea that his suffering was caused by sin. Now, as a matter of fact, he responded to them, if you don't ask Job to pray for you because you've been miscommunicating who I am, then I will deal with you according to your folly. And then secondly, we learn that Job was restored two times everything that he had lost, and he received an extra 140 years of life that he got to see his children and his descendants to the fourth generation. A third, by Job's age, we know that the events must have taken place before the time of Abraham, who only lived to be 175 years old and had received God's strengthening hand for some time. The challenges to the book of Job are really centered in God's statements to Job at the end of the book. Two figures, two beasts that come up in the latter portion of the book have been challenged numerous times, especially by evolutionists, and in a way leveled at the book as mythological. Now, they are called Behemoth and Leviathan. Now, some believe these two creatures are synonymous with an elephant and a hippopotamus, but I'd like to take a few minutes here and discuss why I don't believe that could possibly be the case. And that is because the descriptions in the corresponding passages indicate much more impressive animals, really. Behemoth is in Job 40, verses 15 through 24. And let's go ahead and open our Bibles there, if you don't mind. Job 40, 15 through 24. In Job 40, 15 through 24, God is speaking to Job, and he says, "Behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and the force is in the navel of his belly. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief in the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. Surely the mountains bring him forth food, where all the beasts of the field play. He lieth under the shady trees in the covert of the reed and fens. The shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. Behold, he drinketh up a river and hasteth not. He trusteth that he can draw up Jordan into his mouth. He taketh it with his eyes. His nose pierceth through snares." So this animal that is described here is a grass eater, has a tail like a cedar tree, and bones like bars of iron and brass, that is capable of drinking up a river. With his nose, he's able to pierce through snares, and he's described as chief in the ways of God. Now, if Behemoth was an elephant, there are a few parts of that description that might make sense. Elephants are definitely strong-boned animals. They're big-boned, too. And they are able to use their trunks, their noses, in many very intelligent ways. But an elephant just doesn't fit the description, in my opinion. Because where's the tail? It's like a little whip. Definitely not a cedar tree. And as a matter of fact, the elephant is not the chief of the land animals that God made. If we look at the fossil record, we discover other types of land animals, dinosaurs, in fact, that fit the description much better. So I have a picture up here of Apatosaurus, or Brachiosaurus, I'm not sure which one it was. But as you can see, this is a gargantuan animal. Most of us know what an elephant looks like because we've seen them in the zoos. They're still alive. I've actually ridden on one before, and it is a very large animal indeed. Feels like you're on the top of a boat on the water when you're riding on them. But comparing an animal this large to an elephant is like you being able to accidentally step on a rather large cat. There's just no comparison. Also notice that the tail is very thick, very large, and extremely long, almost like a cedar tree, definitely more like a cedar tree than any tail that an elephant has ever had. Now look at its nose. I'm having a hard time imagining the kind of trap that could contain a monster like this. So big and so strong. You can catch an elephant with ropes if they're done correctly, but it would take a very powerful rope, a very strong rope, chains probably, to keep this kind of an animal from just running through your trap without even realizing it had been stopped. Trying to capture a fully grown sauropod dinosaur with ropes would probably have been a suicide mission for anyone trying to hold on to the other end. You just try to picture that. It's not going to go very well when you barely come up to his toenail. But that's Behemoth. Moving on to the other creature, Leviathan. And this is in the next chapter, verses 1 through 34. We're not actually going to read all of those because that's rather a long passage, but I'll just summarize a few of the things that he is described with. Number one, the doors of his face cannot be opened. Those would be his jaws. In other words, you can't stick your hands in his jaws and pry them open because they are locked tight. That would indicate a very strong jaw pressure, crushing. His scales are airtight, and it almost indicates that he breathes fire. He stirs up the waters, so he's a water creature, maybe also a land creature. He leaves an incandescent trail behind him as he is in the water. Now, when people look at this today, they'll say, oh, it's a crocodile or an alligator. But although alligators and crocodiles do have impressive jaw strength, they probably don't have as airtight of scales, or I've definitely never seen one that can breathe fire. That's the stuff of ancient legend, not a crocodile. But it does have an interesting basis in an animal that did live at one point, in fact. So I have up there a picture of Deinosuchus. Now, Deinosuchus was a very, very large crocodilian animal. It was 10 meters long, so well over 30 feet. This is the low end of the estimates of how large he could have gotten. And you have a human, a 6-foot person, drawn up there for comparison. That's a very large animal. Just a little bit of information about crocodiles as we know them today. Saltwater crocodiles have the strongest measured bite. That's currently at 7,700 PSI. There is another animal that they haven't been able to measure its jaw strength exactly, but the orca whale, they guess around 19,000. Now, a crocodile, here, I'll just go ahead and show you this next picture. There's the difference between their jaw sizes. If that little one is the modern-day crocodile and can create 7,700 PSI of jaw pressure, I think the big one could double, triple, quadruple that pressure without a problem. All right, so 7,700 PSI. Imagine a crocodile big enough to almost fit an entire 6-foot human in his mouth without chewing. That's a big, strong jaw. In the ancient world, this gargantuan monster would probably have been much like a modern crocodile, hunting the dinosaurs as they came down to the river to drink. If you watch National Geographic or Discovery Channel, you can find videos of alligators and crocodiles jumping up out of the water to grab these animals and bring them down into the water to drown them. Well, if you have larger animals that need to be captured, then larger predators can fit the bill. And this Deinosuchus would probably have taken on dinosaurs trying to drown them in the water. Puts a little bit more in perspective. Now, back to this picture. That's a comparison. The smaller one is a modern animal, and the larger one is the ancient reptile. It almost looks like you can fit that whole crocodile in his mouth, but it's a huge animal. And if you look at the very tip of his nose, you'll notice a little bit of an irregularity, almost like a big bulge. Now, some places I've read suggest that this bulging nostril could have been kind of a mixing chamber for gases, similar to what a bombardier beetle would do before it ejects boiling water. Now, if a little beetle can eject boiling water, I don't think it's a stretch to imagine that God could have created an animal that maybe used something like phosphorus, which burns when it's exposed to air, concentrated into this creature's nasal passages that could have been, you know, released. The word in Job is sneezing. It's almost like sneezes out these flames as it's going. And maybe this chamber was part of the mixing process that allowed this unique animal to be mentioned in the book of Job. So, these creatures that are mentioned, I don't believe regarding them as mythological descriptions of an imaginary animal is the right way to do it. I think these are real animals that Job had observed. Beyond the fact that we have fossil records that do possibly support them, you know, directly, we don't have a name, obviously. This is Deinosuchus, Leviathan. We don't have something like that, but we have a record that could match the description. And beyond that, if God is describing a imaginary animal to Job, what good is the description? God's point is, I created these animals. I am so much more awesome than these animals because I am their maker. If he's talking about a fictionary animal, he's more awesome than a fictionary animal. That doesn't communicate the point that he's trying to convey. So I do believe that these were real animals. Christ in the book of Job is revealed, I think, in Job 19, 25 through 27. If you have your Bibles open to Job, let's go ahead and turn there, just a few pages over. Job 19, 25 through 27. This is Job talking now, and he says, "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me." So he is saying that he has confidence he will see his Redeemer, not just with the eyes of faith or in some ethereal future heaven where he doesn't exist, but in his flesh he shall see God. Apparently, God gave Job some kind of special revelation. Now, we don't know how that revelation came. Maybe it was something that had been revealed by Enoch as a preacher of righteousness before the flood. Maybe it was something that was passed down through Noah or his sons if they served God. And maybe God gave it to Job himself. God was communicating with him in the book. But Job had some very interesting knowledge of what God's intention was to provide a redeemer very early in history. And Job had confidence here that his redeemer, Christ, would stand upon the earth, a recognition of Christ's future rulership. And Job had this confidence, not only that his Redeemer would stand on the earth, but that he would be there to see it, even though he died at the present time. So Christ is indeed in the book of Job. Now, I've mentioned it several times, and that is a key theme in the book, the suffering righteous. And really, the suffering righteous takes the form of two questions. The first is, can the righteous suffer? That's the one that Job is asking time and time again as the book progresses. Can the righteous person suffer? His friends don't think so, but he knows that he is suffering even though he has been righteous. Now, Job was one of the most righteous men that ever lived. And if he could suffer, then the righteous can indeed suffer. I have the verse up there, Job 1:8. This is God's description of Job to Satan in the throne room. "And the Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. That's pretty high praise coming from God to Satan. And it was something that Satan had observed as he went up and down walking in the earth, because he responded directly to God, yes, but he has a reason to fear you, and that is because you've been protecting him. But if you look then later on in Ezekiel chapter 14, which let's go ahead and turn there as well, because this is a really interesting passage for Job in discovering who he was. Ezekiel chapter 14, we'll begin reading in verse 12. Ezekiel 14, 12. The word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, when the land sinneth against me by trespassing grievously, then will I stretch out mine hand upon it, and will break the staff of the bread thereof, and will send famine upon it, and will cut off man and beast from it. Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord God. If I cause noisome beasts to pass through the land, and they spoil it, so that it be desolate, that no man may pass through because of the beasts, though these three men were in it, as I live, saith the Lord, they shall deliver neither sons nor daughters, they only shall be delivered, but the land shall be desolate. And we could continue reading through verse 20. Noah, Daniel, and Job, three very righteous men that come up in this prophecy again and again, as men who were righteous. So God is referring to Job and has referred to Job many times in the Bible as a righteous man. And if God is referring to somebody as righteous, then it's safe to say that he is indeed righteous. And that answers our question, can the righteous suffer? With a definite yes, the righteous can suffer. Well, that leads into another question then, and that is, why do the righteous suffer? Now, God does not always reveal the reason immediately. Why is a question that many Christians have cried out to God in desperation through hard times throughout the years. They can find the answer to the first question, does suffering mean that they are unrighteous, in the book of Job? But why is a much harder question to find an answer to when the Bible doesn't describe the exact events that you're going through right now. And Job spent much of the book asking God to tell him why. Why was he suffering? But the answer never came, or didn't come, until much later. And when it finally came, I believe that Job realized his suffering was part of God's plan to bring him glory. Now, if you believe Job was the author and that God did tell Job why he was suffering, then Job must have realized in a much more full understanding what was actually happening behind the scenes. Why do the righteous suffer? Although God might not always reveal the reason immediately, he always uses the suffering for his glory. And that leads right into our application for this evening. Let me ask you, are you going through a rough time right now? Are you suffering? Well, then there are two possibilities to check. The first is God chastening you out of love? Proverbs 3:11-12 says, My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father the son in whom he delighteth. Now, from everything I've said tonight about suffering and the righteous, I don't want you to think that it's impossible to receive chastening if you are unrighteous, and that God will never chasten you if you're practicing evil things. God doesn't promise that. As a matter of fact, the chastening that God brings into his people's lives is to bring them back into righteousness. So it could be a legitimate thing that God is chastening us. There might be something in our hearts that we need to remove. So that is the first possibility. If you are going through a hard time, check. Is God chastening you because you are following the wrong road? You have followed something else instead of him. Could there be an element of chastening? That's something that you have to discover through looking at the Bible and discovering who God is, what he says, and then applying it to your life. The other is God allowing you to be tested in order to make you a purer vessel for his use. Proverbs 25:4 says, "Take away the dross from the silver, and there shall come forth a vessel for the finer." When you have a precious metal, it doesn't come out of the ground in the form that you can use right away. It's got to be sent through the fire. It's got to be heated up, melted down, so it can be molded into something that is useful. It is more beautiful, more useful than after it has been through a harder process than it would have ever been if it were just taken right as it was out of the ground. James 1:2-4 also says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations." That word for temptations is trials. "Knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing." So as we go through trials, temptations, we discover that God is working in us, trying our faith so that we become more like him. Our patience grows, and we become more perfect, more complete, and we don't lack anything for what God wants of us in our lives. Is God allowing you to be tested in order to make you a purer vessel for his use? Whichever one it is, whether God is chastening or whether God is allowing you to be tested, the suffering that God brings into our lives is a vital part of our lives. So, as a final application, final thought, when we are in the middle of a trial, we must remember that God always has a purpose for the difficult times he allows us to experience. And that is the thought that I would like to leave you with from the book of Job. Why do the righteous suffer? Because God has a purpose, even if we can't see it right now. Let's go ahead and close now. Let's divide up for prayer.